Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Welcome back. This is Bill Frank, and you're listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain here on KKZZ, Positive Talk Radio for Ventura and Santa Barbara Counties. Every show has a theme, and today's theme is getting the most out of life. Each of my guests is helping us get the most out of working, eating, or traveling. My first guest is a life coach who taught us about the shift from work style to lifestyle. We discussed his ideas, the law of attraction, and we learned how to monetize our passion. My next guest is best known the world over as the Galloping Gourmet. He'll serve up new recipes and reflections on gardening from his latest book, Growing at the Speed of Life, A Year in the Life of My First Kitchen Garden. As always, if you want to join in the conversation or if you want to speak to Graham Kerr, you can call us at 639-0008. Graham Kerr is a cooking personality who gained fame through the cooking show, The Galloping Gourmet. He grew up in England where his parents were established hoteliers, and he spent much of his childhood among the company of the best chefs of Europe. His wife, Teresa, produced The Galloping Gourmet, a show that was named for Kerr's on-screen persona. The origin of the Galloping Gourmet persona really stems from a 1967 book that he co-authored with wine expert Len Evans. The two of them went galloping on a 35-day worldwide trek to the finest restaurants around the globe, hence the name The Galloping Gourmet. The show was filmed in front of a live audience, which always began with Graham entering the stage area, running and leaping over a chair on the dining room set. The show was known for its lighthearted humor and copious uses of clarified butter, creams, and fat, as well as wine. But then in 1986, Graham was prompted to create a new lifestyle and a new cooking style that he calls Minimax. And then in 2003, Graham received an honorary doctorate for culinary arts and nutrition from the Johnson & Wales University in Providence, Rhode Island. Graham currently lives with his wife in Mount Vernon, Washington, and he joins us from there. Graham, thank you so much for being our guest. How are you today?
You know, not only am I delighted, but I feel I'm probably sharing the same weather with you because the sun has actually come out over our valley at the moment.
Well, we're happy.
Spectacular event.
We're happy for you, and it is a great event because you've sent us the clouds. We've got the clouds and the rain moving in here, so we did a swap.
Okay, that happens. Yeah.
It happens. Now, I grew up watching you on television. You are a pioneer in television cooking with The Galloping Gourmet. How gratifying is it for you to see the emergence of these 24-hour-a-day cooking shows and cooking networks? Could you have ever anticipated a growth in the popularity of cooking that we're seeing now?
You know, I really don't think so. As you know, during our sort of heyday with The Galloping Gourmet, we've done 1,000 television shows since those times, but they've been well hidden on PBS. What I kind of think of is two things. One, I imagine what it must have been like for people who made the old motor cars, the Duesenbergs and things like that. And they made them by hand, and they made them in a shed, and then when they finally had finished doing it, they've just rolled the singular vehicle out. And then compare that with the production line basis that we have today. And I guess for me, it feels that we were tracking something that had not been really tracked before, the live audience and globally going around the world 28 times to pick up the recipes, developing everything so that it fitted into our culture here in the United States and yet was able to be seen in 38 countries around the world. Nobody had ever done that before. And because nobody had done it before, it was just like the old Duesenberg. You know, there was no production line, and yet we did an awful lot of shows. So now I look at it, it's a bit like a production line. If you're going to do 24 hours a day of food programming, you really have to put chefs on a production line.
Mm.
And nowadays it's chefs rather than food-interested people per se, because they have restaurants and it works very well for them and they do a brilliant job. So there's the difference.
I find it very interesting. Now, help me to resolve, Graham, if you can, the paradox that we're experiencing in this country, because on the one hand, we have the explosion of these cooking shows and the networks that we were just talking about, and the popularity of cooking, it never seems to be higher. On the other hand, people are actually cooking less on a daily basis. I mean, what does that tell us about the American viewing audience? Are we just totally schizophrenic?
No, not at all. It's just that in general terms, we can be sold things on two basic principles. One, it's big, and therefore it looks like a lot of something for the money. And that's sort of going away a bit now, you know, the large car and the large mansion and, you know, the everything is big, and although you pay quite a lot of money for it, it seems like a good buy. And then the second thing is that we're sold speed. The latest iPad 2 coming out is a little faster than the first one, and therefore we desire it because it's faster. And that's applied itself to our food, and we have portions which are too large for us to consume properly, and at the same time, we have home meal replacement, which is the largest single component in the food industry in terms of growth. The things that can be done by somebody else for us, and we simply resuscitated in our own kitchens. And that has gone from crummy to really very good. And some of the things are so good that to compete with it on oneself from scratch seems to be like shooting yourself in the foot, especially since it's reasonably well priced at the same time. So where is the attraction of starting something from scratch in one's own home nowadays? You know, that's the issue, and whilst these chefs certainly show that, and I try to do that too, it is a losing battle, because, frankly, if we keep on this idea of speed is everything, then we'll wind up sucking our food through a straw.
Or taking it in the form of a pill. That does make sense.
Exactly. I actually call it TASTE as an acronym, through a straw to everyone. And that's where we're going, yeah.
All right. We're talking to Graham Kerr, everybody. Now, Graham, interestingly enough, in the mid-1980s, you really changed cooking styles to what you call mini-max. First of all, what is mini-max cooking? Why is it important?
Well, I called it mini-max for minimum risk and maximum flavor. And those were in those days, which I still think is a fairly good description, but it's used for vacuum cleaners and heaters and all kinds of other things as well. And I'm now taking the Hippocratic Oath and looking. You mentioned earlier on that I have an honorary doctorate in culinary nutrition. And those two words were never easy bedmates, if you will. You know, the registered dietitian and the chef didn't necessarily get on. Now they're getting on like houses on fire. I mean, this is really important time. So I think now if you said the Hippocratic Oath is do no harm, then the mixture of culinary and nutrition is do less harm, but delight. Or if you will, delight and do less harm. And so that's what that Minimax program is all about. You must retain the quality of food, the things we love about it, the tastes, aromas, and colors and textures of food are so wonderful. And they're such a treat. And it's such a shame that we turn the treat into a threat by large portions and unreasonable amounts of certain nutrients, like, you know, the obvious sodium one, which is being addressed nowadays, saturated fat, which always has been addressed, and refined carbohydrates to some degree. These three things are the three musketeers that simply must be contained somehow and not allowed to spread through our entire diet.
Well, and that does make sense. However, like everything else, in the early cooking days, people would say everything in moderation. I think we've just taken it beyond the moderation stage. But tell me, Graham, if you will, this change that you transformed in the mid-1980s, what was the single event? Was there a defining moment that caused you to come up with the Minimax theory of cooking?
I think the absolute sort of Damascus Road one for me was twofold. One, in my own family, and second, in the world as a whole. In my own family, Trina had a stroke and a heart attack and diabetes, hypertension, and she's married to me, and she was a producer of 1,800 television shows, so obviously a lot of stress in that life. So what do I do for her became the big question, and the biggest question for me. And then immediately when I found an attractive way to be able to serve her day by day. And I've cooked 41,000 meals for her in my lifetime altogether.
Wow.
And that is because Trina actually is a lousy cook. And, you know, this is, I'm protecting myself. She's so wonderful in so many wonderful ways. But that was not one of her things. So that was number one. Number two was the fact I saw that there were, and your previous guest speaks about homeless children in the United States, and I was struck by the infant death rate around the world, under 5 years of age, which in those days were 30,000 children every day.
Mm.
And once every 3/4 of a second, if you will, a child would die. And it's now 22,000 children will die in that way every day. So it seems to me that whilst we're suffering from overweight and obesity in the United States, about 67% if you add the two together, and 2 billion people in the face of this earth are suffering from a lack of food, it seemed to me that if we were to, say, look for 50 cents a day of things that we were doing that would harm ourselves, just as individuals, just 50 cents worth of harm, and if I was to add that up, you know, as a family of four, which I did at the time, that would come out to about $720 a year of things that I was using to harm myself. And if I divided that in half and reinvested half of that in my own lifestyle, whichever way I'd like it, and then invested the other half of that in kids somewhere who were facing this tragedy of life itself, then I would be sort of loving my neighbor as myself, which for me is one of the most important phrases in our world today.
And that's a very important phrase and a very, very worthwhile go. We're talking to Graham Kerr, everybody. Now, Graham, recently you've come back and you've hit the bookshelves with your latest book, which is titled Growing at the Speed of Life, A Year in the Life of My First Kitchen Garden. Now, it's interesting. Your book's kind of a combination of growing secrets and recipes. But what motivated you to write Growing at the Speed of Life?
Well, again, looking at our immediate environment and saying in 08, you know, we are a sad people. We're facing, we're suddenly brought to a place of humility in the United States. We were not everything we thought we were. We may have hyped what we thought we were, and now we were coming down to a reasonable look at what life was about. And maybe that was going to include, if I had a backyard, shoving something into the backyard and growing it for my own kitchen, and that would reintroduce the idea to me and my children and my grandchildren, and in my case, great-grandchildren.
Goodness.
The whole idea that you can scratch the earth and something can come up and you can eat it and it's delicious. And that is something we've sort of dropped the baton of that. We haven't handed it on as skillfully from generation to generation as we once did. And that would be very important. And for all kinds of reasons, I'm a part of a very small church that decided in our very small community to reach out to our very small neighbors and simply say to them, look, unconditionally, you don't have to come sit in the pew with us, but we would like to help you and you to help us plant in our neighborhood enough plants so that we could be neighbors to each other and share the produce back and forth and just simply have a subtle but agreeable idea of a future that could be sustainable rather than run around like headless chickens if everything starts going south in a hurry.
Oh, I love it. I mean, I love the idea. And reading your book, Graham, what I took away from this was that really the book supports local, sustainable, and seasonal agriculture. Now, you're talking to Ventura and Santa Barbara counties. You may not know it, but we're actually very large agricultural counties here. So why is it important to support local agriculture?
We are seeing a government now which is at its own demise. You know, really, our government is saying, how can we offer constituents fewer bribes for their votes in the future? I'm sorry to put it in those rough terms, but I think that's really what it is. We constantly hang out with politicians to see how much we can get out of them in the next range of government services which are rolled out. But in actual fact, what they are now doing and are being forced to do by our circumstances is how do they roll back those programs now from us, the citizen? So I said to somebody the other day, I'm running for public office. They said, wow, are you? What are you running for? I said, citizen. I said, it's about time we became citizens and understood we had a public office to care for our neighbor as ourselves. You know, if we did that, then I think we would see something really start up so that we would be less reliant upon government and more reliant upon our neighborhood. And our neighborhood means sustainability at almost every level in which we do business. when we get to $5 a gallon gasoline, that is going to have a major effect upon huge organizations like Walmart.
Absolutely,
and
it will.
And the little store downtown is going to have a renaissance, and our backyard growing of vegetables is going to flourish in almost instantly overnight. And I just wanted to find out what that was like, and I've never grown anything that ever succeeded except mint, bamboo, and horseradish, which all three of which are very hard to kill.
Yes.
I managed to kill every other plant I tried. And then my neighbors, who were great friends, actually came in and helped me to dig up my lawn and plant this. And now I'm hooked. I mean, I am passionate gardener and promoter of the idea of gardening. And the book really can be used by an expert to help an inexpert person, because it really does. I just hang out with people. I just say, this is how little I knew and how much I got to know in just one season, which has fueled my enthusiasm for the rest of my life.
Oh, that's great. Do you have a favorite fruit or vegetable that you grow in your garden, Graham?
You know, I never had eaten a sun gold tomato, and I realize that Ventura is different from our culture, from our climate up here, but sun gold is one of our most popular tomatoes up here. It's an orange. It's small. It's about under an inch across. It's sort of almost like, you know, whatever they call them, cherry tomatoes.
Mm-hmm.
It has the most wonderful sour sweet taste to it and fragrance, and taken straight off the vine, you know, into a salad or something, it's just out of sight. And then I could keep on talking to you for the next 3 hours, and I could talk about the other 59 plants that I planted, all of which I'm moderately in love with when you think that I'm a human and they are simply a plant.
Well, you're making my mouth water on this end, Graham. We're talking to Graham Kerr, everybody. Graham, what do you want readers to take away from reading your latest book, Growing at the Speed of Life?
Well, if they simply say to themselves, I don't have much time, because, you know, we're obviously a time-ridden people, as I said, but I am feeling like I am being pushed beyond my limits. And what Graham is saying in his book is that he found by growing plants that he had to adjust his speed of life to the growing cycle of plants. And I could see how that might really be interesting for me to do. Not a lot of time, but at least to see what happens naturally, and then to ponder what we are doing and ask whether that is as natural or whether we are in fact exceeding the speed of life.
I think that that is great. We all need to slow down and become more in tune with the seasons. We're talking to Graham Kerr, everybody. His latest book, Growing at the Speed of Life, A Year in My Life of the First Kitchen Garden. Graham, if people are interested in learning more about you, learning more about your book, where would you direct them to go on the Internet?
Well, it's strange. You know, I thought of having a website called Amazon, but it already gone. So mine is as uninspiring as Graham Kerr. .com. It's spelled K-E-R-R.
GrahamKerr.com. Graham, you are a true delight and a pioneer in the field of cooking and, of course, broadcasting cooking. Thank you so much for being my special guest here on Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We'll talk to you down the road.
Okay. Bless you.
Take care.